The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today we're going to be talking about more medieval topics. I think that the Middle Ages, especially the early Middle Ages, is so central and important to understanding where the Western world came from and why it took the forms that it took, at least domestically. And this is true whether you are interested in Eastern or Western Europe, or like me, you're interested in both and see them as forming a larger whole. And today we're going to be talking about Gregory the Great, Pope of Rome, who dies in 604. Gregory the Great is one of the central figures in the early medieval West, if not the central figure in the early medieval West. And you really have only few people who could fit that bill. People like St. Augustine, although an African, a North African, he wrote in Latin. Ambrose is always a possibility. Be the Venerable, Charlemagne, Leander of Seville. There's a lot of people who provide a great degree of spiritual and intellectual significance to this very problematic time in Western European history. We're talking about this struggle to rebuild some rational society on the ruins of the Western Roman Empire. The East had a little different in that the Byzantine Empire, that was quite Roman and still using the Latin language at this time, was intact and, in fact, has quite a long history in front of it. It is the person of the Pope and the monastic institutions throughout Western Europe that gives Western Europe its particular color and particular mission. I want to make it clear, of course, that we are talking about the Orthodox Church of the West, what we might call the Old Catholic or Primitive Catholic Church of the West, in full communion with the Orthodox Church of the East. Gregory the Great is one of these many figures of the era, like Augustine, like Jerome, even Ambrose, John Cassian, that were continually going from East to West and from West to East, showing that this era really is about the universal Christian life of Europe and parts of the Greek-speaking Middle East and parts of the Greek and Latin-speaking North Africa. That this is a singular unity, not two radically differentiated cultural worlds. And a lot of Orthodox people in this day and age view the East and the West as irreconcilable parts of the European world. And I want to talk about an era where that's not the case. Gregory the Great, St. Gregory, or Pope Gregory the Great of Rome, Gregory the First, is one of these absolutely central figures in Western European history, but he's also very important and venerated in Eastern Europe. For those of us interested in the Western Rite in the Orthodox Church, Gregory the Great is another central figure. Gregory the Great is the one who sends St. Augustine to Kent to help re-Christianize the British people. And that liturgy that St. Augustine brings to Canterbury is the liturgy which will eventually be the liturgy of most of England, the liturgy certainly of Northumbria, and especially the center of Northumbria at York. And it's the York Missal that many of us Western Rite Orthodox people will use on a daily basis. And of course, the hours are centered around Saint Benedict, and a Benedictine or Logion is something that is promoted by Gregory the Great. The cult of Saint Benedict is promoted by Gregory the Great. So he is a absolutely pivotal figure in this era, a figure bringing some kind of intellectual civilization. Given the power vacuum and the collapse of moral norms that existed at the time in Italy and Gaul and elsewhere in England, I think in Ireland it was an exception, because I think since Ireland was not really a part of the Roman Empire, she maintained her ancient constitution and the Brehon laws, and by the way, a fairly solid knowledge of not only Latin but also Greek. And Ireland is often neglected in these things, and we can't talk about that now. But Gregory the Great is one of the substantial shining lights in this era. And so what I'm going to do is talk briefly about some basic concepts in his theology and in his writings, in hopes to give you a broad picture of this central intellectual figure of the early Middle Ages, one of the architects of Western European Christendom. I want to say, first of all, that if you could reduce Gregory the Great to a singular maxim, that maxim would be that there is no true natural opposition between matter and spirit. The two are complementary. They are not opposites of each other. And in a perfect world, matter and spirit would be completely and entirely interpenetrated. What we have, the very end of the 6th century, for example, when he's doing a lot of his writing, we have the Eucharist, the consecration of the body and blood by the priest or bishop at the liturgy, as a sign, as a signal about what the perfect world really is. The perfect world, the world prior to the fall of man, however you want to interpret that, this radical distinction between spirit and matter, freedom and necessity. The Eucharist is a symbol and a reality of that reconciliation. It's a symbol in the sense that it shows what all of nature should be. This perfect interpenetration of matter and spirit. It's a reality in that at least on the altar at the liturgy, it is a manifestation of what creation is truly supposed to be. The Eucharist for St. Gregory is a small speck of a glimpse at utopia. It's a small little glimpse at what perfect creation really is. And that's why it's so absolutely central to both Eastern and Western forms of the Orthodox and Catholic Church. Another example of this kind of reconciliation is the saint. And St. Gregory takes St. Benedict as his central example here. A saint, not without sin, of course. All saints are sinners. But the saint is sort of this perpetual Eucharist walking around that acts as, to put it oddly, an ambassador between the worlds of matter and the worlds of spirit. The true ascetic life, according both to St. Gregory and St. Benedict, is not about rejecting matter or the body. That's heresy. That's the old Gnostic heresy that matter is somehow evil in and of itself. But that's not the case. Matter is simply fallen. It must be restored. And the work both of the Eucharist and of the life and struggles of the saint is all about reconciling the spirit with matter, bringing matter to its proper perfection. The Eucharist, as well as the saint, is a symbol of what reality is really supposed to be, what reality was prior to the fall. You see this in Dostoevsky in his short story, Dream of a Ridiculous Man. You see something similar here. this constant penetration between spirit and matter, which is the definition of perfection. The definition of imperfection is the radical separation of the material world on the one hand and the world of the spirit on the other. St. Gregory says that in his day, and maybe it's the case with us too, there's two kinds of Christians in the world. There are those who are freely guided by the Spirit, by the Holy Spirit of God, that is. And that there are those who, although well-meaning, need the discipline of the church or the monastery to keep them on track. Both of these Christians, both of these Orthodox types, will be saved. But the former type is the true life of the saint. The life that doesn't require a constant reminder of the canons and of the commandments of the Christian life. They simply live them spontaneously, sometimes eccentrically. Most of us, however, require a tremendous amount of discipline to keep us on the straight and narrow path. It's those who are guided by the Spirit who are the true saints, the true ambassadors between the spiritual world on the one hand and the material world on the other. But, unfortunately, given the age in which we live, and by the way, I do think that there are some disconcerting parallels between the world of the early 7th century and our very haughty 21st century world. In our days, the direct revelation of the Spirit remains with the very few. Summing it up, what Gregory has really been trying to say in his career is that things in the world can receive and manifest the Spirit. They are not opposites. And that's the basis for the Orthodox belief in icons and in holy oils and in all the sacramentals. And it's something that the Orthodox world will always be in opposition to the Protestant world, which is ultimately a secular world, where the Spirit exists in one place, matter, including culture, by the way, exists somewhere else. No. The ancient church, as proven by Gregory the Great and so many others, says that all aspects of matter must be infused with the Spirit. I mean, this is what holy water is. This is what blessings are all about. This is why Orthodox people bless palms and bless grapes and bless flowers in different feasts of the year. This is a constant icon, a constant symbol of true perfection, which is the manifestation of the Spirit within physical matter. Christ is an example here. Here you have God manifest in physical form. Should be no different in things like art or music or architecture. The whole point of the icon is to show how the Spirit can in fact inhabit, so to speak, the painter's work and then bring the viewer, the person who's contemplating this, to a higher understanding of the world. But this also means, and Gregory the Great is very clear about this, holiness is therefore a deeply social reality. You have to be part of a community in one way or another, whether a parish or a monastery or even just the church at large. Because we're talking about the transformation of material life by the Spirit of God. That's what all of these sacramentals are all about. That's what all the blessings and the holy water and the incense, that's what this all is. When you walk into an Orthodox church, that's what you're experiencing. The concept is to have art manifest the Spirit in such a way that when you immerse yourself in it, you are changed. That's the nature of worship. It's the nature of prayer. It's the nature of Orthodox art, of old Catholic art. The point is to change you. what you do when you go to the liturgical services, or you pray, or you contemplate the icon, or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. The point is to saturate yourself, to immerse yourself in a different world. That's what you are supposed to do. A world of perfection, a world that completely incorporates spirit within the material structure of not just the natural world, but also of society. That's what Gregory the Great, that's what Benedict, that's what so many other of the great saints of the ancient church was trying to tell a world, especially in the West, that had lost its predictability, that had lost its Roman protection. And at the time that Gregory the Great is writing and speaking, the time that Saint Benedict, a little bit before him, is doing his work, it's a time of tremendous chaos in Western Europe, the fall of the Western Roman Empire. What Gregory the Great and Benedict are trying to do is remind Western European humanity, in particular, Eastern humanity has its own problems, but to remind the frightened and increasingly impoverished Western European world that there is a purpose in life. This is that purpose. What people like Benedict and Gregory, Hilary, Leander, so many other people at this time, what they're looking for is stability. They know that the church has it, because Gregory the Great defines stability as constancy in virtue. Gregory the Great loves his Roman background, he loves his Roman heritage, and to a great extent, loves his Stoic heritage. Gregory the Great is very much a Roman. Stability is constancy in virtue, and this will keep you protected even in the worst of circumstances. You see this in Dostoevsky, you see this in Solzhenitsyn. That this kind of happiness, virtue as its own reward, can exist under any circumstances. What is this virtue derived from? Gregory the Great, Benedict, Augustine, so many others in the West, they believe in the primacy of reason. Reason comes to understand the truth of the world via the contemplation of God, specifically contemplation of God manifest in the orderliness of creation, what we mean vaguely by the Logos doctrine. Virtue derives from this understanding. Virtue arises from the fact that God, via the Logos, is active in nature, and this is the cause, the primal cause, of all natural laws, whether it be social or biological or chemical, really doesn't matter. It's one and the same. I want to remind you that many of the ancient peoples, including the Irish, had mastered many aspects of science and medicine in none of the ancient world, but also in the early Middle Ages. Irish medicine at this time is truly a wonder to behold relative to the era. And the same thing for the Greeks. I want to say that the Byzantines at this time are leading a life expectancy about the same as modern America. It's not the case in Western Europe at this time, only because of the extreme decay of morals, of governments, of any concept of natural law or natural virtue. What St. Gregory is trying to say is that when you envision the world and the universe as an ordered whole, when you come to understand the nature of these laws that hold it together, and then the author of these laws, and how that author has revealed himself to men, not just in terms of things like the scriptures and the church, but also in his manifestation in nature, that is the source of virtue, which is not, by the way, all that far from people like Cicero or Seneca or even Marcus Aurelius. That's not a problem. That's something that Gregory the Great fully recognized and fully understood. These were great men. They didn't have the fullness of the truth in Christ as a manifestation of that Logos, but they knew the effects of that Logos. The Orthodox Church has always said that about Plato, from whom a lot of the Stoics take their impetus. And I've said this on this show. It always comes back to Plato. It always comes back to him. I've said that so many times, it's getting old, but the fact is, it always goes back to Plato. Gregory the Great believes, with so many of the Platonic schools, that the world of the spirit is a hierarchic continuum. It starts from God, who is pure spirit, to Christ, who is the spirit manifest, right down to natural law, and then to the actual day-to-day existence of material things manifesting that natural law. Our problem is that we live in a world of fallenness, of sin, and of death. And as a result of that, we obsess so much about our own person, our own security, our own reputation, our money, our whatever it is, that we forget where we truly come from and what we should be doing. The passions, this fear of death, this fear of dishonor, blinds us to the truth of nature, the truth of creation. When this spiritual order is resisted, natural order is overturned. St. Gregory, like pretty much everybody else in the Orthodox world, whether East or West, holds that there is no distinction between the truths of science manifest in natural law, the natural law of the universe, and the, you know, if there's a law, there must be a lawgiver, which is a more or less abstract understanding of how God operates. This law-abiding regularity in all things that are manifest in natural science, which existed at the time in Ireland. It existed among the Greeks. And the Greeks will give it to the Arabs later on. But there is no contradiction between that world and the world of scriptures and the world of the church and of the saints and of the liturgy and everything else. There is no distinction there because we're talking about the exact same thing. We're talking about how God manifests himself through creation. But we're also talking about how to fix, so to speak, that creation from its fallen point of view. Therefore, the end of our life is happiness. This is generally the view of the church, but this happiness, as you'll also see in St. Augustine, can only come about through a union with God, either through a mystic intuition, which exists only for a handful, or the discipline of the church, which exists for the rest of us. Our world, whether it be the world of the late 6th century, or of 2010, our world is one where spirit and matter often exist in a context of disconnectedness, of alienation. That is the ultimate cause of death. It's the ultimate cause of sorrow and pain. All of these, by the way, in Gregory the Great are profoundly unnatural. They exist in a fallen world, but this was not the intention of the Creator. But the big problem, from a social point of view, the big problem in dealing with this radical alienation is this concept of untrammeled freedom. We're not talking about ordered liberty here. That's not the issue. We're talking about this radical freedom of the will, where the will sets itself up as its own God, which, by the way, is just another version of idolatry. Usually when people talk about their will, they're talking about how they have absorbed the universe of the dominant culture, and they believe that their will is their own. The time of Gregory the Great, of course, there really is no dominant culture. A culture is in the process of forming. Some remnants of the old Stoic ideas are around. Plato is still around. And its absorption into the Orthodox system that openly proclaims its love of Plato and the Stoics without any problem whatsoever. The problem is this sense that the will is an idol. The will is a god. I am my own master. Especially given the context of the post-Roman society in the West, that is the most irrational point of view to take. You are not autonomous. Okay, it is time for a break. We will be right back.
go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to The Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about the early Middle Ages again, and specifically, we're talking about the theology of Gregory the Great, Pope of all Rome, who dies in 604. And we left off talking about the problem of freedom, in the sense of making an idol out of the will, that your will somehow is perfect, somehow should be in charge of everything, sort of transferring the attributes of God to your personal desires. That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the concept of the free will. That's not the issue. We're talking about the idea of the free will as being somehow an end in itself. One of these days, I want to talk about St. Augustine and the state, because here's an area where Gregory and Augustine are in full agreement, and that is that the ego is the source of politics. Politics is the arena of naked power and violence, or at least threats of violence, for the sake of extracting resources out of those who are not in power at the time. Politics is an evil for people like Gregory, for people like Augustine. Our social life is natural. Our community life is natural. Political life in the state, they are not natural. Unfortunately, we have to have them because we are ego-driven people. We don't want to necessarily be ego-driven people, but we have to be because we live in a fallen world. We live in an imperfect world. We are imperfect, and things like politics and the state are the unnatural offspring of our wretched state in the world. And it doesn't matter whether we live in their time or in our time, it's the same concept. But autonomy, freedom, in the sense of egocentrism, which does have a pedigree in the modern world, is the cause of politics, in the sense that the ego, without virtue, seeks power, and it seeks power for its own sake. For both Augustine and Gregory, the search for power never ends. People like Dostoevsky have really, you know, scratched their heads about this. And I've said this before on this show. Why is it that the billionaires are never satisfied with their billions? Why don't they just retire somewhere? They keep working. They keep wanting more money and more power. It never ends. More money means higher bills. More money means more problems. More money means more lawsuits, people trying to get their hands on your cash. But this is the offspring of egocentrism. But there is a purpose to power, even in this fallen world, and that the only justifiable purpose, according to St. Gregory, is to benefit others. We talked about this on this show when I talked about medieval political theory. You know, this kind of stuff seems obscure to a lot of people who don't know what they're talking about. But when you read the Middle Ages, in terms of your social theory, ethics, and things like this, you know, they're taking things for granted that modern people have long forgotten about. And that's why this kind of topic is worth discussing. It's really about, changing radically how you think about the social and spiritual worlds. Power can be used for good. Certainly St. Gregory thought that his limited power as Bishop of Rome, which really wasn't all that influential back then, was a way to benefit people. He's certainly sending St. Augustine of Kent, not St. Augustine of Hippo, of course, St. Augustine of Kent, who was in a Roman monastery at the time, sent him to England to re-Christianize the faith with the Roman liturgy. This was a way to benefit people who had part of the truth, but not the whole truth. This is classic Orthodox thinking. St. Gregory said it, St. Innocent of Alaska said it, the pagans aren't totally wrong. In fact, they're not wrong at all. They just don't have the fullness of the Spirit. We can bring them the fullness of the Spirit even within the context of their life. I mean, this is what people like St. Innocent lives by in Alaska. St. Gregory said the same thing. He said to St. Augustine, he said, go to the pagans, go to the Saxons, and use their own way of thinking, just Christianize it. This isn't some kind of conspiracy. It was a common sense approach of St. Augustine. Of St. Gregory, and he didn't try to hide it. These people have some of the truth, but Christ and bringing the Spirit, this is the fullness of the truth. We don't negate the old, we complete the old. But even more than this, positions of authority, whether it be social or religious, should be based on merit. St. Gregory the Great condemned the idea in general of heredity. Or at least he condemned the idea of heredity as the moral basis of authority. I mean, it might be a convenient way to transfer authority. The Romans in the West or the Byzantines in the East, they had no concept of heredity. That's a much later development. But I think it's a development based really on practicality rather than on any kind of doctrine. Romans, Byzantines, even the Russians, had no direct concept that political legitimacy is based on heredity. It can work as a practicality. That's not necessarily a matter of dogma, a matter of deep truth. But for St. Gregory, authority, and you noticed that there actually is a distinction here between authority and power. Authority is about legitimately ruling a group of people, where power is simply the ability to force them to do something. Two very different things. True authority is based on merit, and merit itself really derives from virtue, not from money or from social position. But St. Gregory also believes that the inner workings of the church should be isolated from society. It's not to say that society should not be Christianized. It should be. But that the church as an institution should be separate from power. The church should not be a power. It should be an authority. It should manifest the truth. But that's a far cry from saying that it should become a power in its own right. And the fact is that even though St. Gregory loves his Roman past and cherishes his Roman background, the fact remains that social rank is based largely on fraud. Social rank is based on perception and on money and on your family name, your hereditary background. That's not true merit. That is not true virtue. That's something that certainly, this concept is not particularly modern. This concept is within the ancient and early medieval worlds as well. But the only family that matters is the family of the church, with God as the Father and the believers as the children. And ultimately, for those who are not directed by the Spirit directly, obedience to the teachings of the church, so long as they do not fall into heresy, destroys the ego. And that is a very good thing from a social point of view, from an economic point of view, and from a religious point of view. If you really believe in harmony, you can't enshrine your ego as the center of the world. That is a blatant contradiction, and is, by the way, one of the blatant contradictions in modern thinking. Harmony can only derive, at least in our world, harmony can only derive from obedience and humility. And those two virtues work together. Sometimes you just have to bite your tongue and listen to what the bishop says or listen to what the monarch says, at least for the sake of social peace. This is not just pure quietism. I don't want to say that, because there is this problem of authority that Gregory brings up. What is meant to be destroyed is not necessarily the will, the free will, but the egocentrism of the average person. Harmony can exist, but it has to be based on some form of hierarchy. It has to be based on some level of obedience, and obedience only works to the extent that those who need to obey are humble. But those who command also have to develop the idea of humility as opposed to imperiousness. Unless those who command are virtuous, there can be no harmony. It's not just a matter of social betters commanding social inferiors. That is not the view here. Gregory the Great rejects that kind of distinction. He recognizes that that distinction is probably permanent, but that is a matter of the world being in its present state, not something that is inherently natural to the nature of things. No, power in and of itself can only exist as authority. Authority can only exist under virtue. Virtue can only exist under moral restraint based on humility. There is no concept of a social better being somehow superior to those underneath. That developed in really the feudal mentality, where there were social betters and social inferiors. That is not the mentality of either Augustine or Gregory, although both of them recognize the fact that given the nature of the world, that's where things are moving. But stability is a good thing. Stability can only be based on power being used as authority, not as naked aggression. But that virtue is its own reward. The ruler who is virtuous will not receive the hatred and contempt of those people who are ruled by him. And that the judgment of God exists on this earth as well as in the next world. There is no concept of purgatory in Gregory the Great. In fact, he says that immediately upon death, you are judged to either go to heaven or hell, based on your life of virtue in the world under your circumstances. This is something else that separates Gregory the Great from modern Roman Catholicism, as well as his idea that there is no such thing as a universal bishop, which, of course, is a separate matter altogether. The fact is that Gregory belongs to the Orthodox world, not to the modern Roman Catholic world. But Gregory also holds, remember what I said in the beginning, this whole concept is that the central idea, the central maxim, is that spirit and matter are not contraries. They are, in fact, complementary. There isn't a radical distinction between our world and the next. The next world is a continuation of this one. It's just that God rules the next world, and therefore the judgment is perfect. Authority and power are not different, they are identical in God. He has the power to make you do things, but he has the right to do that. Therefore, there is no deviation from a moral norm in God relative to his ability to bring you to heaven or hell. The fact is that the life that you create in this world dictates your life in the next. If you have created a hell for those under you, then that's where you will live. If you have created paradise for those under you, that's where you will live. Because the use of arbitrary power is not a good thing for those under you, but it's also not a good thing for you. Plato based his whole career on this idea that those people who use power arbitrarily are hurt as much as those who they rule, because their reason is not in charge of their actions. Their passions, their uncontrollable arbitrary passions, are at the basis of everything. That is hell, and that is where you will end up, because you have created that world for yourself, and you've created for the people under you. It is normal, it is just, it is natural. If you rule arbitrarily, whether it be your family or your you know, a political society or a guild or something, you know, you rule them arbitrarily, you place yourself in hell in this world because you have no control of your passion, you have no freedom, your reason has left you. And therefore, it's no surprise that by this pattern of behavior, you have brought yourself to hell. So the transition from this life to hell for such a person really isn't that big of a surprise. It's just a more complete manifestation of what you have freely chosen to create for yourself in this world. And the same thing for heaven. This world is not radically different from the next. You have created it. But the problem is that our universe is this mixture of spiritual and carnal elements. The church is here to teach you how to use both sides. Neither side is better than the other in any real sense. They are both useful. They both have a positive purpose. It's all in how you use it, and all about how you facilitate the interpenetration of the spiritual or the free within the material or the unfree. So that is my talk for today. Gregory the Great is really, there's no overestimating his importance for Western Europe in the early Middle Ages. He is constantly cited. He is constantly quoted. He is one of the central builders of the Western European Orthodox Old Catholic mentality, and as a result, he is a patron of all of us who seek to go back, in some sense anyway, to the world of Christianity before it was rent asunder by the schism of 1054 and its manifestations well into the 12th century. So I thank you for listening. I know this has been something maybe a little dense for a lot of people, but I appreciate your patience, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.